Our second case for this morning is Shvarzinski against Tebbins. And we will hear from Mr. Mayer.
Good morning, Your Honors. Respectfully, my name is James Maher. I represent the plaintiff in this case. Your Honors, Rule 11 sanctions are reserved for rare and exceptional cases. This was not that rare and exceptional case. Discretionary review is not no review at all. Articulated considerations have to support the sanction award.
Now, I have a question for you, though, Mr. Maher, about what is really up here, because you did not take an appeal insofar as any of this pertained to you.
I did. However, the court concluded that because I specifically didn't name myself as a litigant who was taking an appeal, my appeal was dismissed.
All right.
So I certainly intended to. However, it's not before Your Honors.
Fair enough. Not before us. So what I'm concerned about is sorting out what happened on the – I guess there were two appeal bonds, one filed by you with Liberty and the other filed by your client?
There was only one appeal bond.
One appeal bond.
And it was
right.
You jointly filed the appeal bond?
Yes, I did. And I also obtained a stay of enforcement against the judgment pending the appeal, which was ignored by my opponents.
Because what I'm trying to figure out, to put it most bluntly, is if the money has now been paid on your behalf with respect to the full amount of the sanctions, and if for whatever set of reasons you're not an appellant now and it's a full joint and several liability, then I don't see how your opponents would have any right to collect any more from your client. They've already been satisfied. They've collected the full amount, and so I'm concerned to know what is the interest that your client retains on this appeal, since it doesn't seem like there's any money at stake anymore.
Well, they collected unlawfully, number one. There was a stay of
enforcement. He have the right to say that if it's from you that they collected unlawfully.
Well, I say yes. His interests are different from mine. As his attorney, he's been sanctioned himself personally.
But did he see what I'm saying? I mean, you know, if you have defendant A and defendant B in just a regular case, and there's joint and several liability, and there's a judgment for $100,000, the defendant normally can collect that $100,000 from A or from B or 50 each, but not more than 100. And I'm just wondering if they've collected the whole thing notionally from you, then what's left? Now, you may be saying to me, it's not you. Maybe you both contributed to the bond and somehow he still has an interest in it. I don't know. I'm trying to find out.
The bond was joint and several, Your Honor. It was available because I had insurance, which I posted, but I also obtained a stay of enforcement of the judgment in the district court.
And that you
and
have the, that point, yeah.
And the money was collected without going back to the district court to lift the stay. And so these arguments that I'm now being asked to make, I was never given an opportunity to make these arguments in the district court. It was just deprived of me. They collected without going to the court in full, and Mr. Shvarzinski still has the right and the interest in his own personal, individual way to argue that the district court shouldn't have sanctioned him pursuant to a statute that doesn't even apply to him. One.
Well, in asking to have the money returned, as you do in your reply brief, aren't you really trying to appeal the sanction against you? Because it sounds like it's your money that got paid.
Well, in a way, I agree with that, Your Honor. I am asking the court to give back the money. However, that's only one of the remedies I'm asking for. And it's not my money. It's the insurance company's money. It protected both me and the client. And it was was deposited jointly and severally to the court to secure the right of both of us to appeal.
Don't you have to indemnify the insurance company?
Do I have to indemnify the insurance company? We have to sign an agreement whereby they're going to post the bond, and that's what happened.
You know, I guess it's of some importance to me to know exactly what your client's interest is in this bond. And as you point out, the way everything has unfolded, there are no materials on record about the nature of the bond, who has a financial interest in it, who would get the money if the money were returned, et cetera. And so I would appreciate your filing maybe a letter or a brief statement to that effect with the court within what do you think, 10 days or so of this argument, just so that we can have some concrete facts. And if you have anything further you would like to say about it, you'd have another 5 days to respond.
That'd be fine. How many days, Judge? I apologize.
10 days from today.
I will do that.
So rather than spend the whole argument on this point, so we can move on.
Thank you, Your Honor. My client is the litigant. He cannot possibly be sanctioned under a statute that doesn't apply to him.
But on that point, why shouldn't we read what the district court did as really simply citing Rule 11 or 1927 in the alternative? 1927, to the extent somebody's a litigant, I agree with you, doesn't seem to apply, but Rule 11 does apply to parties.
The court said we were sanctioned under both.
Right. And yeah. So why doesn't both mean either one's enough?
Well, I assume the court agrees with me that Mr. Schwarzynski could not possibly have been sanctioned under 28 U.S.C. 1927, but that's what happened.
It's my understanding of the record that that's correct, since I don't think he ever filed an appearance as a lawyer.
No, he did not.
Okay.
So clearly the court erred in imposing any sanctions against Mr. Schwarzynski under a statute that clearly does not apply to him.
Yes, well, there's a lot of case law going the other way. What do you?
Respectfully, Judge, I think those cases involve attorneys who actually litigants who participate as attorneys, people who argue to the court, people who file motions, people who file pleadings. Respectfully,
there,
I've never seen it.
There's a D.C. Circuit case and a Eighth Circuit case, and I don't think they.
If my opponent did not cite any.
Your situation.
My opponent did not cite any cases.
Hughes versus Hoffman, you came with that?
That wasn't cited. And
I'm not. Kinsley versus Mitchell, that's D.C. Circuit. You came with that one?
Judge, I've never seen
both,
a seven.
They both applied the 1927 to the client, I think.
Respectfully, there's no way that statute can possibly apply to anyone who does not participate in the matter as an attorney. The express meaning of the statute is completely obviated and ignored. Rule 11 also hasn't been violated, respectfully. This is not the type of a case where the merits were ever considered. The court invited me to file an amended pleading, and I obeyed the court order. How is that sanctionable conduct, though? Mr. Schwarzynski had the authority as president to file the lawsuit. The court concluded he didn't.
The court looks at this lawsuit at the very outset and expresses very serious doubts about it, and it goes on for 9 months. Our standard of review is abuse of discretion, and these are not, I mean, you're not complaining about the amount of the sanctions. I understand that. It's the fact of.
Right.
But it looks like the court attempted to be very proportional in its sanctioning decision. So it reminds me of the last case we just heard. Given the standard of review, how can we say the court abuses its discretion when there seems to be so little underlying this case?
The court has to have articulated considerations under In re Ronco, and the considerations don't make sense. The court says that Mr. Schwarzynski was the real party in interest. That's clearly incorrect. The court said that there's no conflict of interest. That's clearly incorrect. Mr. Schwarzynski never waived the conflict of interest. We did a motion to reconsider because that issue wasn't before the court, whether he waived it or not. How can I be sanctioned for that? The court invited me to file an amended pleading, and I was sanctioned in any event. The court concluded.
Well, it's because of the content of the amended pleading. Just because the court says, well, you know, I'm going to give you one more chance doesn't mean you have one more chance for just anything.
Respectfully, the content of the amended complaint was never considered. The merits were never considered. The court said that the RICO claims can be salvaged and that they might have merit. And so the merits were never considered. Judge, all we have is one pleading that the court felt wasn't specific enough. And then the court sanctions me for doing something that I've been given permission to do. It seems to me that the merits have to be considered, Your Honors, respectfully. The court has to look, as a finder of fact and a applier of law, that the merits are somehow never going to pan out. And that certainly didn't happen. We had a deposition from a witness who testified in support of the complaint. We had affidavits from the plaintiff that I attached to my motion for a TRO that went uncontradicted. And the court still sanctioned me. So there were facts before the court that supported the cause of action. And there was case law that supported the cause of action that says that there doesn't have to be just one intended victim of a RICO conspiracy. There can be more than one intended victim. And all the allegations I made with respect to my client, Judge, were in the original complaint, right from the very start. So the court concludes, well, you're asking for something that's wholly inapplicable to the complaint, but it's in the complaint.
And of course, there are a lot of problems with the complaint, starting with the fact that you were invoking the labor management, the LMRDA, but it doesn't apply to public unions. The Chicago False Claims Ordinance doesn't seem to apply here. There was a lot that was, and also that this was really an internal union matter for which there are labor law remedies.
If I could, I'd address that and reserve some time.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, I just reserve a little time, Your Honor. And there's nothing in RICO that says it doesn't apply to internal union disputes. There's no case law that says that. This man had an injury that was, and so did the city, so did the union. It seems to me he had a right to have that claim evaluated, but it was not evaluated. Rather than assume the truth of the facts, as the court was required to do, it disputed them. Okay. Basically, the court concluded, well, your facts are never going to amount to anything, Mr. Maher, so I'm going to sanction you. I respectfully submit that that's not the purpose of Rule 11. To dismiss people and throw them out of court without hearing the evidence.
Okay, and you can save the rest of your time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Right, Mr. Horowitz.
May it please the Court, Stephen Horowitz, and I represent the 15 defendants appellees in this case. In the district court, we're referred to as the local two defendants, who are 10 of the 13 members of the Chicago Firefighters Union Executive Board, and the five international defendants, the international union itself, its president, and three district vice presidents. If I may briefly address the question of the stay of enforcement. The motion that Mr. Maher made in the district court was to stay enforcement pending the appeal. Well, his appeal was dismissed. And in fact, and he doesn't point that out, before I collected on the bond, I wrote to him notifying him that he should pay up now that his appeal was dismissed. He never replied to that. I wrote to the bonding company. I sent him a copy. He never replied to that it would be improper to collect on the bond. And so I did collect on the bond. His case was gone. We had a right then to go against him since he was jointly and severally liable.
And you collected the full amount.
Yeah, we seek nothing more in monetary damages against Mr. Schwarzynski. And, in fact, we did point out in our motion to suggest that this appeal is moot because of this court's own rulings that if there's no monetary issue involved, that the fact that the court may find that the attorney or the party has acted improperly, that in itself isn't a claim that is really justiciable. It's really the monetary claim, and we have no claims against Mr. Schwarzynski having collected the full amount under the bond.
Okay, so when Mr. Maher files his statement, as I said, you'll have another 5 days after that to respond any way you think appropriate.
And I would point out, with respect to 1927, that statute reads, an attorney or any person admitted to the bar who vexatiously multiplies the proceedings. Now, Mr. Schwarzynski is an attorney. In fact, when we appeared before Judge Guzman on April 27th of 07, Mr. Schwarzynski, who made arguments before the court along with Mr. Maher, represented to the court that he would soon be filing his appearance in that case. Now, granted, he never did file that.
He never did. I mean, there's a fair question about this statute when it refers to any attorney or other person admitted to conduct cases in any court of the United States who so multiplies the proceedings, whether that means a person who is acting as an attorney as opposed to a pro se litigant. Now, as I say, I just think that's a fair question of interpretation about the scope of 1927.
But I think that Mr. Schwarzynski went beyond that by, in fact, the complaint did have a signature line. I don't know if the original bore his signature. But in any event, under Rule 11, certainly that the claims made in this case, and from beginning to end, Your Honors, this case was frivolous. From the very time that that this complaint was filed in April 16th of 07.
So why did Judge Guzman, it sounded a little reluctant, but why did Judge Guzman say, the RICO claims might be salvaged.
Well, the only...
He should have just dismissed them
He did it because they're not in the factual allegations. In the three RICO counts, the legal complaints, he accused all the defendants of the crime of mail fraud. So the judge said, well, if you complete mail fraud, and he mentions nothing about use of the mails in the original complaint, about fraud in the original complaint, the court allowed him to do that. But the original complaint, the first three counts under RICO, one count is based on violations of the, one predicate act is violations of a law that prohibits embezzlement of welfare funds. Of course, it doesn't take much to see that the welfare funds, and the statute refers to that, welfare funds that are administered or governed by ERISA. First of all, Local 2, the union, is not in a welfare fund. Secondly, ERISA does not apply to public sector entities. The second count was that the under Section 501 of the LMRDA prohibits embezzlement of union funds. Again, that specifically excludes anybody who is a public sector union. It didn't take much to, for an attorney to have known that that those statutes do not apply to the Chicago Firefighters Union.
Judge Guzman didn't refer to Charzynski as acting as an attorney, or didn't mention the his role in arguments in his sanctions ruling, did he?
No, he didn't say that. Although,
so what did he do to, what did the judge do to distinguish between the attorney and the client here in terms of who was responsible for the frivolousness?
Well, in the response, I believe, to sanctions, the claim is made that both Mr. Charzynski and Mr. Baher investigated these actions together. And obviously, the claims about alleged allegations of embezzlement, those came from Charzynski. In fact, Judge, at the very outset, the claim is made that, that Mr. Maher claimed that he had no notice not to proceed with this action. Notwithstanding the fact that on April 19th, 3 days after the complaint was filed, I, as well as the attorney, Mr. Woodley, the attorney for the international defendants, wrote to Mr. Maher and Mr. Charzynski advising them that the Local 2 Executive Board, in the votes of 11-1, determined that he should cease and desist bringing that action in the name of Local 2. And not only did the Judge Guzman, at the, in his decision on April 30th, denying the temporary restraining order, he found that they had, even if Mr. Charzynski at the outset could have filed that case, he found that the union constitution and bylaws provided that the ultimate authority went to the executive board. And indeed, within a month after that, the union membership at a meeting ratified a similar proposal or resolution telling Mr. Charzynski to cease and desist. That never happened. They persisted with the motion for reconsideration, and we had to brief the motion to dismiss. And at some point, Mr. Maher says, well, we'll wait until the court rules on whether or not I should, Mr. Charzynski should be substituted.
Okay, now I have a question for you, which goes to whether these sanctions are proper only if the entire case, 100% of it, is sanctionably frivolous, or whether it's enough for the district court to say that it's mostly frivolous, but maybe not entirely, because I'm looking at the district court's May 12, 2008 order, and toward the end, he summarizes. He says, in short, though they were told almost immediately after filing it, and so forth, that the suit couldn't be maintained in the union's name, and most of the claims asserted in it were legally unfounded. Charzynski and Maher vigorously pursued this case. In doing so, they violated. So he's not saying that it's 100% frivolous. Now, is that a proper use of Rule 11?
Yes, in fact, Judge, I believe this court, as well as other courts, have found that if you bring a case for an improper purpose, even if there are proper motives, that improper motives, proper purpose for bringing that case in and of itself warrants sanctions.
But he didn't find that it was improperly motivated, did he?
Well, he did find...
The proper purpose. He found it was unfounded in law and fact.
Well, he found that the... And, in fact, at the TRO hearing on April 27th, he said, you're making these allegations under RICO about embezzlement. How does that fit into your claim that you, Mr. Swierczynski, at this point, who's not even a party, are coming in for a TRO to block an internal union hearing? And that was the improper purpose, attempting to block an internal union hearing, which, based on charges that Mr. Swierczynski had misappropriated funds, and that those charges were eventually sustained, and he was removed from office. In fact,
are you saying that he found, as far as the TRO went, that had an improper purpose?
Well, the purpose of bringing the action, the TRO was the initial foray into that. Yes, that's where he wanted the TRO, was to stop that proceeding. And I think that's why he put all this window dressing about RICO and LMRDA, which had absolutely no bearing, to try to get this foot in the door for some federal jurisdiction. But the purpose of this was to stop that union hearing, which the court denied, finding that there was a negligible likelihood of any success on the federal claims, and finding that he was not a proper party. He was asking for relief even though he wasn't a party, and he was bringing it in the name of Local 2, even though he had been cautioned by, directed by Local 2 to cease and desist in that. And in reading the Judge Guzman's order on sanctions, he does point out the 9 different reasons he found that these actions were sanctionable by both. And I would point out, Judge, that similar to this court's recent decision in the Sheriff of Will County case, where the plaintiff there dropped five of his counts when the summary judgment motion was filed, here, when I moved to compel discovery against Swierczynski, on the date he was supposed to reply to written discovery, December 24th of 07, he voluntarily dismissed the case, which was on the very day he had to reply, and which was 10 days before his deposition was ordered by the court to be taken. So I think that shows an abusive process after both sides of the defense, produced over 2,000 pages of documents to Mr. Swierczynski. And then he got those documents, and then when it was time to put up or shut up, if you will, he drops out of the case. And the deposition referred to by of a union officer by Mr. Meyer, I would point out that deposition wasn't completed on December 21st. It was scheduled to be resumed on December 26th. Of course, by that time, the case had been dismissed, and I received a letter from Mr. Meyer saying, if you try to proceed with that deposition, you'll be subject to sanctions. So that was an incomplete deposition, and as I would point out, Mr. Swierczynski, at that trial board hearing, when asked to identify who among the Local 2 officers, the 10 he claims committed embezzlement of union funds and of City of Chicago funds, he said he couldn't remember except one name. And that is pointed out in the briefs as well as the letters preceding the Rule 11 motions. I see my time is up. Thank you. And we think that under the abuse of discretion standard, the judgment of the district court should stand. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Anything further, Mr. Meyer?
This gentleman was removed from office for $708.36. I argued that the union board proceeding would be a farce, and it was. The rules weren't followed. They removed him from office anyway, took away his salary. The lawsuit never reached the merits, respectfully. When Your Honor asks counsel whether most of the claims were found to be unfounded, that's not accurate. Only 2 of the counts of 7 were dismissed with prejudice. The RICO claims were never reached. The merits were never reached. The 9 reasons that the district court gave, not one of them says that the lawsuit was filed for an improper purpose. The words improper purpose appear nowhere in the order. There's no basis for a finding that this lawsuit was filed for an improper purpose. My client was the president of the union. The court can't interpret the bylaws for him. On the day he filed the lawsuit, he was the president.
Well, he did find that the request for the TRO was wholly unrelated to the claims.
That's correct, however.
So that's an improper purpose of that particular vehicle within litigation, isn't it?
Assuming that to be true, Your Honor, that's not accurate. That's a misinterpretation of the complaint, which was detailed and specific and talked all about the plaintiff's injuries personally and what they were going to do to him and why they were going to do to him, why they were going to do it to him, and they did it exactly as my client predicted. They removed him from office. I don't know. His salary is $180,000, I believe, over a $708 bill. He was removed from office. He's no longer the president of that union. And we argued all those facts, Your Honor, in the complaint. They're all in there. And the court did not assume the truth of them. He just ignored it. And I also submitted an affidavit in support of the TRO motion, which went completely uncontradicted. I don't know how the court could ignore that, but that's what the court did. The court, I realize the court has the right to deny my motion, but that certainly doesn't mean the whole complaint is now meritless and that I should be sanctioned under a punitive rule that has to be specifically and looked at, and there's got to be articulable reasons to support a sanction award, which is clearly not the case here. The issue of demanding him to withdraw the lawsuit, we didn't refile it in his name after we were ordered by the court. But we needed some case law or some authority why they think we should just summarily dismiss it. And when we ignored it, of course, that's when the sanctions came. And that's, of course, what this whole thing is about, the sanctions and the personal animosity that's been throughout this lawsuit. Respectfully, Judge, discretionary review doesn't mean no review. There has to be reasons to support the court's award. The court said that RICO claims can be salvaged and might have merit, and we have a witness who supported everything Mr. Schwarzenegger testified to, including the fact that they railroaded him. Testified at his deposition under oath before the voluntary dismissal was taken. A witness who's independent, he was railroaded. These gentlemen are embezzling from the union. They're engaged in misconduct. That testimony was ignored, and I was still sanctioned. Respectfully, that's not the purpose of Rule 11. Rule 11 is designed for conscious, willful acts in violation of the rules, and that is not what happened here. Mr. Schwarzenegger has a remedy. Your honors are the only ones who can give him that remedy. I ask that the sanction against him be reversed, and I'll have that document to your honors in 10 days.
Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. We will take the case under advisement.